in Chicago. Also today, Tom Rex Tillerson for Secretary of State.
Was the night before Christmas, and all through the house, not a creature was stirring, not even a mouse.
In my mind,
joyous day.
to all our family and friends. I want you to remember this last.
From the Temptations.
This is Chicago's finest internet radio show, making a world a better place, one show at a time. The George Warner Jr. Show is now on the air. Take it away, Dad.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Sit down. Okay. Welcome to the George Wilder Jr. Show on Block Talk Radio. I hope you're following the show. Hope you're following me, the show itself, and because we're live. We're live, but we are a podcast. This is internet radio. We are all over the globe. We're worldwide. I mean, I have guests. I get calls from just about anywhere in the world, the universe maybe. And that's thrilling. That's totally, totally thrilling. My guest today is Nancy Sindelar. She's an author, and we're going to find out what the hell she's going to be talking about if she shows up. But anyway, welcome to the George Wilder Jr. Show on Black Talk Radio. It is cold outside, folks. It's just like I was saying yesterday on the show. If you haven't listened to that show, go back and podcast it. 2016. But you know what? It is cold. I mean, it is so cold. I'm getting cold just by saying that it's cold. It's dangerously cold. It is Arctic weather. They're talking about 6 below zero tonight, and tomorrow's going to get worse in the city of Chicago. 16 below zero. Ooh. However, Chicago is not the only place around the United States that's cold. I mean, I think majority of the country is cold. It's freezing. It's just you freeze your ass off out there. And that's no joke. And it's not funny. It's the truth. But you know what? Some people still want to get out there and fool around, you know, mess around in the cold Arctic weather when it is dangerous. But if you want to get out there and freeze your ass off, you go right ahead. All righty, it is dangerous cold. I want to say, if you have to be out there, you know, dress properly, bundle up. Like I was saying yesterday on the show, dress properly, bundle up. Gloves, hat, earmuffs. A lot of people don't like to wear hats. I see a lot of people walking outside with they got on gloves, they're bundled up, but their head is out, their face is out. And, you know, they try to pretend like they're not cold, but you can see that their nose is turning red. Their face is red. I'm not cold. Yeah, okay. All right. If you have to be out there, then bundle up. If you don't have to be out there, then do not go out there. It is cold, people. It is freezing. And the thing about it, I'm going to say the same thing I said yesterday. It's cold as hell, but it's not even winter yet. Actually, officially, by the calendar, if you look at the calendar, it is still fall. Winter doesn't come in until next week. But it's been cold for a few days now. And they're saying that it's only going to get worse. So, you know, if you don't have to be out there, don't go out there. You know, don't go out there. I mean, people are, you know, as I speak, people are stocking up on food. The grocery stores and the supermarkets are pretty, pretty damn crowded. People are stocking up on food as if the store is going to run out of food or something. They're stocking up on food as if the stores may not have food in the next hour or so. They're just grabbing everything they can, you know, and then they're hustling back home, right? Hunkering down because it's freezing outside. And it's only going to get worse. So I want to say something to my seniors out there, the elderly, bundle up if you have to be out there. But if you do not have to be out there, don't go out there. And another thing to the seniors and the elderly, do not open your door. If you're living alone or whatever, even if you're not living alone, if you're a senior, do not open your door unless you know who's out there knocking on your door. If you don't know the person who's knocking on your door, do not open it. If you didn't call the police and somebody knocks on your door and said, we're the police. If you didn't call them, do not open that door unless they can show you a badge or something. Because the bad guys are out. This is the holiday season. The bad guys are out there. And they will knock you in the head or worse and take your property. So, you know, if you don't have to go out there in this damn cold, and it is damn cold, stay inside. Listen to the George Wilder Jr. Show, whether you're listening to me live or you listening to a earlier podcast of the show. It's better than going out there and freezing your ass off. I'm telling you, it's cold as hell out there. And I'm not joking. And it's dangerously cold. And that brings me to my next topic. One of the shelters, if not all the shelters in Uptown in the city of Chicago, the shelter where there's, you know, where the homeless cater. This is a shelter for the homeless, and this shelter is closing. This shelter is going to close its doors December 23rd, 2 days before Christmas. You're going to have people out in the street, out in this blasting cold weather, because the shelters are closing up because there is no budget. There's no money. So this is what we get with this governor, this Republican governor, who will not sign a budget into office, who will not sign a one budget into law, and a budget that the Illinois Constitution requires him to do. And all of the social programs that these people need and rely on are disappearing. Shelters in Uptown in Chicago has always been a place for the homeless, the needy, because you have all these social programs that they can, you know, use. They can utilize these programs, and they do. You know, these people are homeless. They're the working poor. They have part-time jobs. They don't get paid much on their jobs. And the rent is so high in Chicago, they can't afford it. So a lot of these homeless people are homeless, but they have jobs. But they just can't afford a decent apartment or to buy a home or something. So they have to stay in shelters. And in some of these shelters, they're sleeping on the floor. But that's better than sleeping out in the cold, you know, or somewhere out in the cold in the parks or whatever. But still, it's awful. They have for a long time been renovating and upscaling Uptown in the city of Chicago. Uptown is a beautiful, beautiful community. There's no doubt about it, but there's this area, there's this section of it that caters to the homeless population. People who have nowhere to go, they're hanging out on corners. They're, you know, walking around the area. You know, they're they're like a fixture in this certain area of Uptown in the city of Chicago. It's a beautiful city. I mean, it's a beautiful city, and that's a beautiful community. But some people think that the area where the homeless and the you know, sheltered are, that's, let me put it this way, folks. They want to get rid of the homeless. They want to drive the homeless people out of the area because they're restructuring it. They're rehabilitating it. They're building apartments and luxury apartments, condos in the area, and they want to push the homeless people out, period. And this is going on right now. They are constructing a new train stop, the CTA's train stop. It's going to be beautiful at Wilson and at Wilson, let me see, Wilson and Broadway, of course. And they're constructing it, and they're doing all this renovation. They're doing all, they're just fixing up the area. And obviously it's going to drive more homeless people out, along with the budget cuts. There's another shelter in Uptown called Cornerstone. That's going to be closing pretty soon, I'm pretty sure. They have already, may have already, you know, decided to move because of the funding. And Bruce, I mean, you throw these people out in the cold on the 23rd of December. If any one of them freezes to death, we should hold these politicians' feet to the fire and just call them what they are, murderers, because they refuse to do the right thing and fund these programs so these people can have somewhere to go instead of hanging around on the street and being thrown out to freeze to death. It's just crazy. Okay, it says right here, the shelter at 4941 West Lawrence in Chicago, Uptown, is slated to close for good on December 23rd, 2016. For good, because of financial problems. Except for some protesters, there is no real effort afoot to keep it open this week. What most agree is a clear need for its services. In other words, our politicians, they have turned a deaf ear on this. This is going to happen. People, families are going to be thrown out into the street. The elderly, it doesn't matter, young, old, you know, you're going to be thrown out in the street. If you don't have a place to stay, if you're homeless in Chicago, you're fucked. That's the best way I can say it. You're fucked. You know, because nobody cares anymore. Nobody cares. It's Christmas, so hey, wow, you don't have yours. You're out in the street, you can't afford nothing, you're poor, you're fucked. That's the bottom line. That's what the mayor is telling these homeless people. That's what the governor is saying. That's what some of these city leaders are saying. You know, you're screwed. There's a lot of protesters out there right now protesting this, rallying against this. But hey, wow, these guys who are in power to do something, they are not going to do anything because they just don't give a damn. They just don't care, do not care. You know, so this is a rotten deal for the city of Chicago. You know, I mean, they're pushing the homeless people out because they are building luxurious apartments, their condos. Stores and businesses are starting to come into the community, and this is going to run the homeless people out. Some of them have left already. Where did they go? I don't know. It's just heartening that these people in office, politicians, are just crazy. And you know, we're going to vote these guys out. Don't worry about it, folks. We're going to vote them out. All right, you've been listening to the George Wilder Jr. Show on Block Talk Radio. And I'm shaking because I'm thinking about how cold it is, and it's just going to get colder. And wherever you are in the world, I hope that you are keeping warm. All right, you've been listening to the George Wilder Jr. Show. We will be right back. Let's do this. All right, Donald Trump. All right, Donald Trump met with Kanye West today. And one of the things they've talked about, I've heard that they talked about several things. They've talked about violence in the city of Chicago. Okay? They discussed violence in the city of Chicago. They will not, you know, specifically say what they've discussed, but we found out that they did discuss violence in the city of Chicago. And something we haven't seen any action on Obama on the violence in the city of Chicago. So this is a swipe at Obama, I believe. I think Kanye is just taking a swipe at Obama, even though Obama poll numbers, I understand, is pretty high. I don't know why they're high in the black community. I don't know why. He hasn't done a damn thing for the black community. And I'm not the only one saying that. There's other leaders saying that also. And it's true. And it's true. So I think that's a swipe at Obama. I think a lot of things that Trump does is a swipe at Obama. Obama has no legacy. And don't tell me about Obamacare. That is crap. So that's interesting, though. And Trump said on a video that Kanye was a good guy. And so they met. We're going to try and get some more details if anything drips out. But Kanye West met with Trump, the rapper. Now, I'm no fan of Kanye West, but I do understand him when he's talking about violence in the city of Chicago. Because we've got leaders all over the place who can't seem to come up with any plan, with any solution to ending the carnage that's happening in the city of Chicago each and every damn night. You know, so we're going to see where that goes. And if Trump has ideas on getting the violence in the city of Chicago down, I want to hear it. I totally want to hear it. Because if I can say it, the police superintendent haven't got a clue. He hasn't got a clue. Mayor Emanuel, he hasn't got a clue. And Governor Bruce Rauner is blaming the budget crisis on the crime in the city of Chicago. Now, if that is so, then why don't you get a budget so we can stop some of this violence? But he won't. He's saying that the budget is the reason why. Not having a budget is the reason why we have so much crime. But he's the culprit to why we do not have a budget. So you can blame him if you want to. It don't make a lot of sense on the crime in the Chicago area because he refuses to work with the legislature in Illinois to get a budget. That would be reasonable to think. But Kanye West met with Trump today. That's interesting. And what else is interesting is that the number of blacks who actually voted for Trump over Obama's candidate, Hillary Clinton. That's something. Okay, you've been listening to the George Wilder Jr. Show, folks. Thanks for tuning in. It's 6:25 in the city of Chicago. And let me go back and say once again, it is cold. It's cold. I'm getting cold just saying it's cold. It is something. So if you don't have to be out there, then don't go out there. It's cold. It's going to get even colder tomorrow night from all weather reports. And I believe them because it is nippy dippy. Okay, you've been listening to the George Wilder Jr. Show. Keep yourself warm if you can. And if you have to be out there, get to where you're going and get back home or get to someplace where it's warm. Remember, I just got through saying a lot of people are going to be in the cold because come December 23rd in Chicago, some shelters are going to be closing their doors. So a lot of homeless families are going to be left in the street 2 days before Christmas. Can you believe that? these assholes, politicians are going to let these people freeze. And if these people freeze out there because they don't like each other, these guys should be taken out in handcuffs. All right, you've been listening to George Wilder Jr. on the George Wilder Jr. Show. We have someone on the phone. Let's go to the phones right quick. All right, you're on the George Wilder Jr. Show. Go right ahead.
Well, hello, George, and hello, George's audience. This is Nancy Sindelar. I am the Sindelar. Author of Influencing Hemingway.
Thank you for coming on the show. Thank you for coming on the show. And I want to say to my audience, this is Nandy Sindelar on the George Wilder Jr. Show. And she's going to be talking about her book, Hemingway. You know, I am a fan of Ernest Hemingway. I've gotten some of his work on my Kindle. And he was just such an extraordinary writer. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, sure. I mean, one of the reasons I wanted to be on your show, George, is that Hemingway grew up in Oak Park. And so things that I talk about in my book actually started with his early life in Oak Park. Now, there are a lot of people out there that think Hemingway hated Oak Park and that he didn't come back because he thought it was too conservative. But in my book, I talk about how he really got a good education there. He got a very strong Midwestern work ethic that got him through a lot of tough times. And that he had a lot of really positive experiences, particularly in high school. So he went to public schools in Oak Park. He went to Oliver Wendell Holmes School as his elementary school, and then he went to Oak Park High School. And what's really neat about doing the research on him, and I have pictures of this in my book, is that he was just as active and interesting as a teenager as he was as an adult. And he was on the football team. He was on the track team. He was editor of the school newspaper. He played the cello in the orchestra. And he just did all these things. So if there's ever a commercial for public education and a good school system, it's Ernest Hemingway's life in Oak Park. And when he was a senior in high school, he was editor of the school newspaper. And he had a really cool journalism teacher his senior year who ran her classroom like a newspaper office. And so kids had the opportunity to be the editors of the paper or write sports columns or do news stories. And he really profited from that. And when he finished high school, his family very much wanted him to go to college, but he decided no, he wanted to go out and get a job. And he went to Kansas City and became a cub reporter for the Kansas City Star. And throughout his life, whenever he needed money or he wanted to get to a particular war or something in Europe, he would go back to journalism. And so not only was he a cub reporter for the Kansas City Star, he wrote articles for the Toronto Star and was involved with the North American Newspaper Alliance, which got him to the Spanish Civil War. And then during World War II, he was a reporter for Collier's Magazine. So, I mean, one of the things I got out of doing the research for the book is not only did he write all those great novels, but his nonfiction is really pretty interesting, too.
Yeah, I mean, he's like I said, I've got some of his writings, and I'm just as enthralled as ever. I think he penned something. Didn't he write something about how he write or something to that effect?
Well,
then he penned something.
Yeah.
Go
one
right ahead.
Of the things that made his books so interesting and so memorable is that he wrote what he called the iceberg theory, where unlike a lot of other writers, he didn't tell his readers what to think. So his characters are characterized through what they say and what they do. And he doesn't tell you, hey, you know, this guy's a bad guy or she is a tramp. he just kind of lets these characters talk and act, and then the reader kind of comes to their own conclusions about these people.
Yeah.
So you wind up bringing a lot of your own life experiences to the story.
Mm-hmm.
So the reason it's the iceberg theory is he writes 1/7 of the details. The other 7/8 you bring to it from your own personal experience. And that's what, and is one of the things that keeps Hemingway, you know, really on the bestseller lists and so interesting to people.
Yeah, that's interesting. And that's interesting. I think every writer should probably adapt to that. Let the reader come to the conclusions on which character is bad, which character is ruthless or good or whatever. That's a good concept. That's a good premise to start from. So how do you think Hemingway felt when the Hollywood came calling on him, making his books into movies?
Well, yeah, all of his major novels were made into movies. So he got paid a lot of money for that, and he very much liked income from it. But he wasn't particularly thrilled with the outcomes because, you know, usually if you've written a book or if you really like a book, when you see the movie, you're kind of disappointed. So he was a little bit disappointed in the films. But one thing that's interesting is that he had friends from all walks of life, and he loved to hunt and fish, so he spent a lot of time in Cuba.
I heard that.
And some of his friends were, you know, relatively impoverished Cuban fishermen, and you know, I mean, he had friends from all walks of life because he spent a lot of time hanging out at harbors and boats and stuff like that. But after his books were made into movies, then he also was friends with the rich and famous. So one of his big buddies was Gary Cooper. He went hunting with him. He knew Ingrid Bergman, and Ava Gardner supposedly swam naked in his swimming pool in Cuba. And Ingrid Bergman was in his film For Whom the Bell Tolls. So he what was really cool about his life is that he had friends from all social and economic levels. And he was a person that people either really liked him, or, you know, he didn't mince any words either. He had a few enemies along the way.
I was reading something somewhere.
Dangerous about being Hemingway's friend was that you would show up in one of his books. And so there were some characters in
A
Sun Also Rises that he met when he was in Paris. And, you know, they're supposedly the lost generation, and they drank a lot, and they were promiscuous, and they did a lot of crazy things. And these people that he knew when he was in Paris, who wound up in The Sun Also Rises, were shocked when they read the book, because everybody knew who he was writing about. But he would put his own little spin on it. So it was really kind of dangerous to be his friend, even though he was a lot of fun to be with.
Well, I think most writers probably do something like that, something similar to that. I have done it. You know, I've done it. But I wanted to ask you, how did the Nick Adams stories come along?
Well, Hemingway spent the school year in Oak Park, but every summer he and his family would go up to northern Michigan. And because back in Hemingway's day, there was no air conditioning, and Oak Park was as hot and humid in the summer as, you know, Chicago is now. All of us who live there know how hot and humid it gets. So people would have summer homes up north where it was cooler. And his family had a home on Walloon Lake. So Nick Adams is a character that's really Hemingway. And the experiences that Nick Adams has are Hemingway's experiences as a young boy or as a young man. And, you know, one of the famous stories is Indian Camp. And that's very autobiographical in that in the story Indian Camp, the father goes off to this camp where there are Native Americans who are participating in the logging industry that was going on in Michigan. And this doctor takes the young boy with him. Well, Ernest's father was a medical doctor, and he would go to these Indian camps and help deliver babies or help people that had been seriously injured. So, I mean, it's highly likely that story is pretty close to something that Ernest Hemingway experienced as a child.
Well, they always say, write what you know.
Well, he did. Yeah. And actually, that kind of impacted the end of his life. He was suffering from depression. And
yeah, I heard about it.
Life, his fourth wife took him to the Mayo Clinic, and he had electric shock therapy there. And that erased his memory. And so he couldn't write anymore. And, you know, a lot of scholars believe that that was one of the motivations for his suicide.
I also heard or read somewhere where his father actually committed suicide also, and it kind of carried over.
Yes, he committed suicide. There are two Hemingway houses in Oak Park. Mm-hmm. There's a home where he was born, and that's now a museum. So any of your listeners that are interested in visiting his house, it's open to the public. And he lived there until he was about 6 years old. And then there's the boyhood home, which is currently a private home, but it is also in Oak Park. And it was in the master bedroom of that house where his father, Clarence Hemingway, committed suicide. Ernest was not there at the time. He was living in Key West, Florida. He was about 28 years old when his father committed suicide. But, yeah, that's that runs in the family.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that it impacted Ernest heavily, and and maybe that's one of the reasons why he took his own life. I mean, I was shocked and surprised when I found that out. Because he was just such an amazing writer, and it kind of bothers me when a writer passes away, whether it's suicide or just from a other causes.
Right. Well, he had a very full life. I mean, he certainly, by the time he ended his life at age 61, had done more than most
That's
men
young.
In their life. And he lived all around the world. I mean, he started out in Oak Park, but he spent time in Italy and in France and was involved in the Spanish Civil War. He lived in Cuba, and then at the end of his life, he was in Idaho. And that's actually where he's buried, in the cemetery in Ketchum, Idaho.
You know, there's a lot of books out there written on Ernest Hemingway. Why did you choose to research and write about him?
Well, many years ago, I taught American literature at Oak Park High School. And my students would always say, oh, Hemingway had such an interesting life. And, you know, they were sort of jealous of him and thought their own lives were kind of boring in comparison. So back then, I just went to the high school library and looked at the 1917 yearbook. And that's when I found out all the things that Hemingway did when he was actually in that same high school. So I used that information and told my students, look, you know, you don't just suddenly have an interesting life. Look what he did when he was right here in Oak Park. And I had these pictures. And then many years later, there was an opportunity to give a talk in Cuba. And I submitted a proposal because I had these pictures. And I thought, well, I'll talk about the adolescent Ernest Hemingway. And that talk was really well received because these people didn't really know about the young adolescent Hemingway and how rich his education was and how involved he was in high school and everything. So one thing led to another. And at first I was going to write a book on the young Hemingway, but when I got into the publishing stage, the publisher, Roman and Littlefield, wanted me to write about his whole life. So I did.
Wow, and it's interesting.
The book is called Influencing Hemingway. The People
and Where Can We Find It?
Shaped His Life and Work. Well, it's available on Amazon,
mm-hmm.
both in an e-reader version and hard copy.
Mm-hmm.
And bookstores also will order it. And
will you be right?
Go
I was going to say, will you be writing any more of these kind of biographies?
Well, I one thing that's sort of interesting about Hemingway, and I might write about this, is that he had a pretty extensive FBI file. And so I've now read his entire FBI file, and so I might do something on that. But I give a lot of talks on Hemingway, so if any of your listeners are interested, they can go to my website, which is nancysindelar.com. And I talk about Hemingway's women. I talk about the places that he lived. I talk about Hemingway in war. I talk about Hemingway and the FBI. These are all separate presentations, but I've given them all around the world. And the other thing I'm involved with that your listeners might be interested in, and maybe you want to go too, George, is that we're going to have a tour to Cuba that focuses on Hemingway. And it's in February, the 18th through the 23rd,
mm-hmm,
and
mm-hmm.
it's 5 days. And if mm-hmm. people are interested, it's promoted on the Key West Art and Historical Society website.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to be
obviously
talking about Hemingway, and we're going to go to all his haunts, which include a lot of bars and restaurants in Havana.
Sounds like fun. Sounds like it's going to be fun. Obviously, you are very, very excited writing about Hemingway, because he was such an exciting individual as a writer. And you find him,
I've had a blast just writing on his coattails for the last couple of years. Mm-hmm. Ever since the book has come out, it's just been one thing after another, including being on your show, which I appreciate.
Oh, thank you very much. Thank you for being on my show. Thank you for being on the George Wilder Show, author Nancy Sindelar. Thank you for being on the show. You know what I'm going to do? I'm going to send you a link to this show, so maybe you can put the link up on your website and people can come by and listen to you. I'll talk about Hemingway on this show.
Excellent.
All right.
Thanks, George.
Okay, thanks. All right, thanks for being on the show. Bye-bye. All right, the great Nancy Sindelar on the George Wilder Jr. Show, talking about one of the great writers of the 20th century, Hemingway. All righty. Take a little break here. Ernest Hemingway.
I'm Keith Olbermann, and this is The Resistance. We have elected an idiot. For all the insanity and the stunning self-absorption and the bullying and the delusional view of America that would embarrass a high school dropout watching cartoons while strung out on meth, the much more existential threat from the Swiss cheese personality of Donald John Trump roared to the forefront over this weekend past. And that existential threat is simply this. In the complex international relations that, like it or not, keep the world from blowing itself up every afternoon, Trump has just proved he has no earthly clue what the fuck he is doing. Just since last Friday, Donald Trump has given aid and comfort to our Russian enemies who are aiming for nothing short of world prominence with the help of their jackass Trump. He has undermined this nation's status as the only enforcer left on the side of human rights. And he has screwed up, whether inadvertently or as reported Sunday night deliberately, nearly four decades of diplomacy balanced on a razor's edge with China and Taiwan. And just as that China and Taiwan diplomacy began to stabilize, he went and screwed it up again on Twitter. Good work, moron. You don't have to live next door to the United Nations to understand why talking to the president of Taiwan and making it public and referring to the close economic, political, and security ties between Taiwan and the United States just increased the chances that Trump will get some of us, including his supporters, killed. Since 1979, we have played a silly little childish game with mainland China. If we don't make a big deal about that island of Taiwan, if we don't call it a nation, if we recognize that psychologically Taiwan is to the Chinese what communist Cuba has been to us since 1959, if our diplomats and presidents and dipshits elect like Donald Trump don't rub China's nose in it, the Chinese will not wipe the more or less democracy of Taiwan off the freaking map. It's that simple. The 1,350,000,000 mainland Chinese communists will not turn the 23.5 million Chinese on Taiwan into a parking lot. All we have to do is not do exactly what Donald Nitwit Trump did by saying what he did to the Taiwanese president last Friday. But of course, he did it because he thinks he knows better than everybody else about the world when he doesn't know shit. And anyway, what's the fate of 23.5 million Chinese on Taiwan compared to what really matters? The president of Taiwan called me today to wish me congratulations on winning the presidency. Thank you. Interesting how the U.S. sells Taiwan billions of dollars of military equipment, but I should not accept a congratulatory call. Because clearly the point of an incoming presidential administration is to see how many leaders around the world call in to tell him how terrific he is. We now see, 6 weeks out from the inauguration, the outlines of the Trump doctrine. Congratulate Trump! Sunday, a crowded elevator's worth of trumpets pushed a story in the Washington Post that this was all planned. It was a more robust defense of Taiwan, which is, of course, even dumber, especially if the idiot-elect has to publicly disguise his planned robustness as naivete, because, of course, he then gets mad when people call him naive, and so thus he doubles down on the whole thing Sunday night on Twitter. So now not only are the Chinese pissed off, not only is their help in whatever looms next for us in North Korea in jeopardy, and not only is an actual slow growth in the reliability of the relationship between our two countries at risk, but who benefits from uncertainty between the U.S. and China? We don't win from it. The Chinese don't win from it. In whose interest is the new confusion, the new setback, the new ass-hattery from Trump? Russia. Always Russia. Russia. And by the way, guess what flooded out of a WikiLeaks dump Saturday that you probably didn't hear about? 90 gigabytes, 2,420 documents of intelligence related to Germany and the German president Angela Merkel, ahead of Germany's upcoming elections. Germany, which since Trump's election by a minority of our voters has already taken our place as the leading democracy in the world and the only Western power able or willing to stand up against the passive-aggressive world war that Russia has been waging for several years, now with the aid and comfort of President-elect Donald bumbling amateur Putin puppet fucking Trump. And yes, I said Trump's election has already resulted in Germany taking our place as the leading democracy, the leading enforcer on the side of human rights in the world. And if these fiascos with China and Taiwan and WikiLeaks in Germany are not evidence enough, there was a third Trump diplomatic disaster that might actually have eclipsed the other two. Philippines President Rodrigo Duterte the street thug who has had thousands of his citizens murdered by police and vigilantes without trial, or in many cases without even arrest, on the pretext of an anti-drug campaign. Duterte says he too got on the phone with Trump on Friday, and that Trump endorsed the barbarism Duterte has unleashed. I could sense a good rapport, an animated president-elect Trump, and he was wishing me success in my campaign against the drug problem, Duterte said. He understood the way we are handling it. We are many things in this country, but we have never and must never stoop to murder disguised as law and order by a dictator who has compared his own actions to those of Adolf Hitler as if he were complimenting himself. Worst yet, Duterte said this buffoon Trump has invited him to visit New York and Washington, and bluntly, Rodrigo Duterte should not be admitted to this country, even in a casket. But don't tell Trump that. He knows everything. If this is how this dense, pea-brained little man is going to run things, if this is how far in over his own fat orange head he's going to be internationally, if this is how he is going to strut as president, a triple-chinned bull in a nuclear China shop, he cannot be allowed to become president. Because after January 20th, if he decides to have a week of prioritizing receiving congratulations for his inaugural and tweeting out his petulance about Chinese taxes, if he can't manage to keep his fucking ego out of these opaque but essential balancing acts, the ones which stitch together the world as it is, he could get us all killed before his next appointment with whoever or whatever colors his goddamned hair. Resist. Peace.
There's no doubt. Keith Olbermann is pissed off. This guy does not like Donald Trump. He is totally pissed off. And I agree. I do think Trump is going to get us into war. Maybe more than one. This guy is he's trying to be a different kind of a president. Okay. Not like Obama or the presidents that became before. He's trying to be a different kind of president. And a lot of the leaders, foreign leaders, they don't like it. I don't like it. A lot of us think that some of the people that he's selecting to run his cabinet are criminals, are thugs, are racists, against everything. But we're just going to have to see. January 20th, he will be sworn in as president of the United States, the 45th president of the United States. And there are still some people saying that it's an illegal election. There are still people saying that I'm not for these recounts. I really am not. I'm not for these recounts, because a lot of these recounts will just cement his win. You know, and in some cases, more votes will be found for Donald Trump during a recount. So the guy's president, no matter, even if he has Russian ties, and it's proven, they can't impeach him. They can do that, but I don't think they're going to. I don't think they're going to impeach him. For one thing, they're not going to impeach Donald Trump, because the Republican runs, they run Congress. They would have to do it. Oh, you know, they would have to do it. Whether there's Russian interference with the American election, you know, they're not going to impeach this guy. You know, if Russian hackers are found concretely to have helped Trump win the election, this election should become null and void. It should become null and void, because, you know, Putin is a murderer and a thug. You know, I mean, and the Russian government, they're laughing at the United States. You know, they are literally laughing. You know, they are laughing. So this is not going to be over for Trump. Trump is talking about 8 years as president. Good Lord, he'll be 80. He's talking about 8 years as president. And that can't happen. 8 years as president. But you know what astounds me is how many African Americans that voted for Trump. I mean, overwhelmingly, a number of African Americans voted for Trump. a lot of these African Americans who voted for Trump voted for Obama twice. They were just fed up with Obama. They were just, you know, fed up with Obama's shit, and they voted against him. I voted for Obama twice, and I have always been fed up with his stuff. Even back in his first term, I was so pissed off, I didn't know what to do. I couldn't believe some of the things that he was doing or not doing. You know, so, you know, and that's why so many pissed off African Americans went out there and pulled that lever for Trump. I'm not going to say there was a landslide out there of African Americans voting for Trump. There was enough African Americans who voted for Trump to put him over the to put him in the White House. And, you know, I'm about to say I don't blame them for voting for Trump. I mean, that was a slap. Voting African-Americans voting for Trump and putting Trump in office and later on shaking his hand and winning this thing. I think that's an embarrassment for Obama, because Obama was out there like he was out there full force. He was all in for Hillary Clinton. There was no doubt on God's earth, Hillary Clinton would have been a third term for Obama. She would have been a third term. There is no doubt about it. Neither one of them would deny that. She'd have kept in all of his policies. If she had been a third term for Obama, the same kind of crap would have continued, whatever the hell that was. The same kind of stuff would have continued. But Trump vows to be different. You know, remember, folks, Trump used to be a Democrat. He was a full-blooded Democrat, I guess, until he figures that he saw the light. And they said, no, I'm going to be a Republican. You know, so he used to be a Democrat. I mean, in some cases, some people still think that Trump has some Democratic blood still inside of him. Well, let's hope so. Or some independent blood inside of him. All right, you've been listening to the George Wilder Jr. Show. Thanks to my guests, my wonderful guests, my great guest, Nancy Sindelar, for teaching us a little bit more about Ernest Hemingway. And if you don't know who Ernest Hemingway was, he was one of the best writers of the 20th century. A lot of his books were made into movies. And I can understand when I heard her say that he was disappointed in some of his movies, in some of his books being made into movies. I don't think I would want any of my books made into movies because Hollywood, there's no doubt about it, Hollywood messes up your book. I mean, you've heard this old saying before. The book is always better than the movie. And there is no doubt about that. The book is always better than the movie in some cases. But in rare cases, the movie is maybe better than the book. Or they're on an even plane. Come to mind is To Kill a Mockingbird. The book is great and the movie is great. But that's very rare. When a book is adopted into a screenplay and the screenplay becomes a movie. That's very rare. But generally speaking, 99.9% of the time, the book is going to be way better than the movie. And we're going to talk about that tomorrow. But thanks to my guest, Nancy Sindelar, for bringing up that topic, because that's a very good topic to talk about, especially with authors. But we all have to realize that each author is different. Each author is different. Each author approach writing differently. You know, I cannot write like Stephen King, or I cannot write like Dean Koontz or Danielle Steele. I have to write the way I write. You know, they are authors and they're writing the way that they write. And if you're a writer, you have to write what you feel, and you get to put your own voice down there on paper. You know, all writers are different. No writer is the same. All right, you've been listening to the George Wilder Jr. Show on Blog Talk Radio, and that was just a great conversation. I really, really enjoyed it. 347-857-1762. The George Wilder Jr. Show is now on the air, and we're all about making the world a better place. But also, folks, don't forget to check out my book. This is the last night that it's going to be free. This is the last day it's going to be free. Then after tonight, you're going to have to pay for it. Okay. But I think it's a good enough story that it's worth it. It's called Hit Me and You Die. It's the title sounds, I know it sounds over dramatic, but the title fits what's inside of the book, the content of the book. And it's in Kindle form on Amazon. Okay. So check that out and check a lot of other writings out on Amazon. All right. You've been listening to the George Wilder Jr. Show on Blog Talk Radio. Let's do this doorbell. Can we get the doorbell? What about the drum? Can we do the drums? All right. We shall be right back.
I'm here today to talk about a disturbing question, which has an equally disturbing answer. My topic is the secrets of domestic violence. And the question I'm going to tackle is the one question everyone always asks. Why does she stay? Why would anyone stay with a man who beats her? I'm not a psychiatrist, a social worker, or an expert in domestic violence. I'm just one woman with a story to tell. I was 22. I had just graduated from Harvard College. I'd moved to New York City for my first job as a writer and editor at 17 Magazine. I had my first apartment, my first little green American Express card, and I had a very big secret. My secret was that I had this gun loaded with hollow point bullets pointed at my head by the man who I thought was my soulmate many, many times. The man who I loved more than anybody on earth held a gun to my head and threatened to kill me more times than I can even remember. I'm here to tell you the story of crazy love, a psychological trap disguised as love, one that millions of women and even a few men fall into every year. It may even be your story. I don't look like a typical domestic violence survivor. I have a BA in English from Harvard College, an MBA in marketing from Wharton Business School. I spent most of my career working for Fortune 500 companies, including Johnson & Johnson, Leo Burnett, and The Washington Post. I've been married for almost 20 years to my second husband, and we have three kids together. My dog is a black lab, and I drive a Honda Odyssey minivan. So my first message for you is that domestic violence happens to everyone. All races, all religions, all income and education levels. It's everywhere. And my second message is that everyone thinks domestic violence happens to women, that it's a women's issue. Not exactly. Over 85% of abusers are men. And domestic abuse happens only in intimate, interdependent, long-term relationships. In other words, in families. The last place we would want or expect to find violence, which is one reason domestic abuse is so confusing. I would have told you myself that I was the last person on earth who would stay with a man who beats me. But in fact, I was a very typical victim because of my age. I was 22. And in the United States, women ages 16 to 24 are three times as likely to be domestic violence victims as women of other ages. And over 500 women and girls this age are killed every year by abusive partners, boyfriends and husbands in the United States. I was also a very typical victim because I knew nothing about domestic violence, its warning signs or its patterns. I met Connor on a cold, rainy January night. He sat next to me on the New York City subway, and he started chatting me up. He told me two things. One was that he, too, had just graduated from an Ivy League school and that he worked at a very impressive Wall Street bank. But what made the biggest impression on me that first meeting was that he was smart and funny. And he looked like a farm boy. He had these big cheeks, these big apple cheeks, and this wheat blonde hair, and he seemed so sweet. One of the smartest things Connor did from the very beginning was to create the illusion that I was the dominant partner in the relationship. He did this, especially at the beginning, by idolizing me. We started dating, and he loved everything about me, that I was smart, that I'd gone to Harvard, that I was passionate about helping teenage girls and my job. He wanted to know everything about my family and my childhood, my hopes and dreams. Connor believed in me as a writer and a woman in a way that no one else ever had. And he also created a magical atmosphere of trust between us by confessing his secret, which was that as a very young boy, starting at age 4, he had been savagely and repeatedly physically abused by his stepfather. And the abuse had gotten so bad that he had had to drop out of school in 8th grade, even though he was very smart. And he'd spent almost 20 years rebuilding his life, which is why that Ivy League degree and the Wall Street job and his bright, shiny future meant so much to him. If you had told me that this smart, funny, sensitive man who adored me would one day dictate whether or not I wore makeup, how short my skirts were, where I lived, what jobs I took, who my friends were, and where I spent Christmas, I would have laughed at you. Because there was not a hint of violence or control or anger in Connor at the beginning. I didn't know that the first stage in any domestic violence relationship is to seduce and charm the victim. I also didn't know that the second step is to isolate the victim. Now, Connor did not come home one day and announce, you know, hey, all this Romeo and Juliet stuff has been great, but I need to move into the next phase where I isolate you and I abuse you. So I need to get you out of this apartment where the neighbors can hear you scream and out of this city where you have friends and family and coworkers who can see the bruises. Instead, Connor came home one Friday evening, and he told me that he had quit his job that day, his dream job. And he said that he had quit his job because of me, because I had made him feel so safe and loved that he didn't need to prove himself on Wall Street anymore. And he just wanted to get out of the city and away from his abusive, dysfunctional family and move to a tiny town in New England where he could start his life over with me by his side. Now, the last thing I wanted to do was leave New York and my dream job. But I thought you made sacrifices for your soulmate. So I agreed, and I quit my job, and Connor and I left Manhattan together. I had no idea I was falling into crazy love, that I was walking headfirst into a carefully laid physical, financial, and psychological trap. The next step in the domestic violence pattern is to introduce the threat of violence and see how she reacts. And here's where those guns come in. As soon as we moved to New England, you know that place where Connor was supposed to feel so safe? He bought 3 guns. He kept one in the glove compartment of our car. He kept one under the pillows on our bed. And the 3rd one he kept in his pocket at all times. And he said that he needed those guns because of the trauma he'd experienced as a young boy. He needed them to feel protected. But those guns were really a message for me. And even though he hadn't raised a hand to me, my life was already in grave danger every minute of every day. Connor first physically attacked me 5 days before our wedding. It was 7 a.m. I still had on my nightgown. I was working on my computer trying to finish a freelance writing assignment, and I got frustrated. And Connor used my anger as an excuse to put both of his hands around my neck and to squeeze so tightly that I could not breathe or scream. And he used the chokehold to hit my head repeatedly against the wall. 5 days later, the 10 bruises on my neck had just faded, and I put on my mother's wedding dress, and I married him. Despite what had happened, I was sure we were going to live happily ever after, because I loved him, and he loved me so much. And he was very, very sorry. He had just been really stressed out by the wedding and by becoming a family with me. It was an isolated incident, and he was never going to hurt me again. It happened twice more on the honeymoon. The first time, I was driving to find a secret beach, and I got lost. And he punched me in the side of my head so hard that the other side of my head repeatedly hit the driver's side window. And then a few days later, driving home from our honeymoon, he got frustrated by traffic, and he threw a cold Big Mac in my face. Connor proceeded to beat me once or twice a week for the next 2.5 years of our marriage.
He sure is.
I was mistaken in thinking that I was unique and alone in this situation. 1 in 3 American women experiences domestic violence or stalking at some point in her life. And the CDC reports that 15 million children are abused every year. 15 million. So actually, I was in very good company. Back to my question. Why did I stay? The answer is easy. I didn't know he was abusing me. Even though he held those loaded guns to my head, pushed me downstairs, threatened to kill our dog, pulled the key out of the car ignition as I drove down the highway, poured coffee grinds on my head as I dressed for a job interview, I never once thought of myself as a battered wife. Instead, I was a very strong woman in love with a deeply troubled man, and I was the only person on earth who could help Connor face his demons. The other question everybody asks is, why doesn't she just leave? Why didn't I walk out? I could have left any time. To me, this is the saddest and most painful question that people ask, because we victims know something you usually don't. It's incredibly dangerous to leave an abuser, because the final step in the domestic violence pattern is kill her. Over 70% of domestic violence murders happen after the victim has ended the relationship, after she's gotten out, because then the abuser has nothing left to lose. Other outcomes include long-term stalking, even after the abuser remarries, denial of financial resources, and manipulation of the family court system to terrify the victim and her children, who are regularly forced by family court judges to spend unsupervised time with the man who beat their mother. And still we ask, why doesn't she just leave? I was able to leave because of one final sadistic beating that broke through my denial. I realized that the man who I loved so much was going to kill me if I let him. So I broke the silence. I told everyone. The police, my neighbors, my friends and family, total strangers. And I'm here today because you all helped me. We tend to stereotype victims as grisly headlines, self-destructive women, damaged goods. The question, why does she stay, is code for some people for it's her fault for staying, as if victims intentionally choose to fall in love with men intent upon destroying us. But since publishing Crazy Love, I have heard hundreds of stories from men and women who also got out, who learned an invaluable life lesson from what happened, and who rebuilt lives, joyous, happy lives, as employees, wives, and mothers, lives completely free of violence, like me. Because it turns out that I'm actually a very typical domestic violence victim and a typical domestic violence survivor. I remarried a kind and gentle man. We have those 3 kids. I have that black lab, and I have that minivan. What I will never have again ever, is a loaded gun held to my head by someone who says that he loves me. Now, right now, maybe you're thinking, wow, this is fascinating. Or, wow, how stupid was she? But this whole time, I've actually been talking about you. I promise you, there are several people listening to me right now who are currently being abused, or who were abused as children, or who are abusers themselves. Abuse could be affecting your daughter, your sister, your best friend right now. I was able to end my own crazy love story by breaking the silence. I'm still breaking the silence today. It's my way of helping other victims. And it's my final request of you. Talk about what you heard here. Abuse thrives only in silence. You have the power to end domestic violence simply by shining a spotlight on it. We victims need everyone. We need every one of you to understand the secrets of domestic violence. Show abuse the light of day by talking about it with your children, your coworkers, your friends and family. Recast survivors as wonderful, lovable people with full futures. Recognize the early signs of violence and conscientiously intervene. De-escalate it. Show victims a safe way out. Together, we can make our beds, our dinner tables, and our families the safe and peaceful oases they should be. Thank you.
All right. All right. We are advocates here on domestic violence. I write about it all the time in a fictional sense. We have to do something about it. It's rampant. It's happening as we speak, as I speak, you know, so we have to do something about it, because the George Wilder Jr. Show is all about making the world a better place. And once again, I want to thank my guests, the energetic Nancy Sindelar, for being on the show. It was great. I try to have the best on the show, folks, as you can probably see, because it's all about making the world a better place and one show at a time, just one show at a time. And we are, let's see, it's cold. What can I say? It's about 9 degrees in Chicago, and it feels even colder than that. So I want to say once again, as I've stated at the beginning of the show, stay warm. If you don't have to go out there, don't go out there. But if you have to be out there, bundle up and get out of the cold as fast as you can, because this is Arctic cold. This is that biting cold. I mean, you feel it. It runs across your face, and you feel like somebody even took a razor and you know, just cut you across your face. It is just that bad. I'm getting cold just talking about it. It's freezing out there. So if you're in a place where it's warm, bless you. But majority of Americans around the United States, we're in a deep freeze. Well, it reminds me of a book I've written called The Deep Freeze. It's pretty good, folks. It talks about cold weather too, but the book is probably around three years old, but it stands the test of time. So, you know, it's going to be cold for the rest of the week. They said it's going to get nothing but worse. So you guys out there, you girls out there, make sure you bundle up when you go out there. It's you don't want to freeze your ass off. And I don't mean that in a sarcastic way. I mean that in a real way, because things like that can happen. All right. We're going to take a short break right now, and we're going to be, if we can find this, okay, let's try Headhunters. I haven't heard it in a long time. It's a great song.
The George Wilder Jr. Show, the talk of our times, is now on the air. Welcome, everybody.
All right. Once again, Chicago shelters are closing because we have no budget. And they're talking about a budget for next year. Well, obviously, this place is going to close. It's closing two days before Christmas. A lot of people are going to be homeless because the shelters are closing down because we have no budget in the state of Illinois. And it's all the governor's fault. It's all his fault, but he's going to try and blame Democrats. And another thing I want to bring to your attention, a lot of the legislatures, a lot of the lawmakers in Springfield, in Illinois, they are not getting paid. They have not gotten paid in 6 months. They're not getting paid. Why? Because a lot of the people are saying that they're not doing their jobs by getting a budget. So if a lot of us aren't getting paid, they're not getting paid either because they're not doing their jobs. But a lot of the lawmakers, I mean, they don't have any other income but their legislative income, and they're not getting paid. And Rauner, he's rich. He's making money heads over. He doesn't need a paycheck. He's a billionaire. Madigan doesn't need a paycheck. He's a millionaire. Cullerton, these guys don't need a paycheck. But some of the other people who work in the legislature, they do need a paycheck, and they're not getting paid. We're going to talk a little bit more about that tomorrow. We're going to talk about the closing of this shelter. People are going to be homeless 2 days before Christmas because the shelter itself is in $100,000 hole that the politicians say that they don't have. So, you know, it's just a mess. I mean, once this shelter closed because of budget cuts, there's going to be more. I mean, it's not going to stop. Every shelter in the city of Chicago is going to be closed down. They're going to have homeless people all over the place, sleeping in cars, sleeping in the parks, freezing to death. It's just not fair.
Bombs begin to fall. Anyone you ever saw? Heaven help the black man if he struggles one more day. Heaven help the white man if he turns back away. Heaven help the man who kicks the man who has a claw.
Oh, yeah.
All right, folks, you've been listening to the George Wilder Jr. Show. We're practically off the air. I want to say join me tomorrow, and all good things will start again. A great show today. Thanks to my guest, Nancy Sindelar. And we're going to talk more about what's going on in the world tomorrow. Thank you for being here. Thank you for downloading. Thank you for podcasting. Remember, Blog Talk Radio. Bye-bye, everybody. Check me out tomorrow. This is George Wilder Jr. signing off.